Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Let's summarize the problem that I'm going to be specifically addressing. We addressed this problem when we went through the text. We'll summarize it again quickly now. As you go through the story, which we're fairly familiar with, let's just start in verse 11 on your sheets there. The first page is the text of the story, which we've been through many, many times. Verse 10 and 11, Avraham stretches forth his hand to take the knife to slaughter his son, and the angel of God calls out to him from heaven and says, Avraham, Avraham, and he says, here I am. Avraham, he responds to the angel. It's the same words that he responds to God, the same words that he responds to his son. Here I am. And then in verse 12, and what I want to pick up on, let me just lead into what I want to point out is, there are two angels that are going to call out, and I want to point out to at what point in the story we receive the blessings. At what point of the story, if you have to say, okay, where is the end of our story? Where does the binding of Isaac's story end? So one could have made an argument of, right here in verse 12, Abraham responded, Hineni, I am here, to the angel. And the angel said, do not stretch forth your hand to the lad, nor do anything to him. Now I know that you are a God-fearing man, since you did not withhold your son, your only one, from me. Excellent, you passed. Don't do it, the angel says. Don't touch him. Don't do anything at all. I now know that you're a God-fearing man. You didn't withhold your son. Take him down, go home, and live happily ever after. In the writing of the story, if there were such a thing as a storybook version of the story, that would be the end of the story. Could be the end of the story. Now, that's, by the way, I just want to point out how funny that would be, a storybook version of a father slaughtering his son. But leaving that aside, he made it. He passed the test. But we find that that's not the end of the story, even though that could have been, because what we then have is verse 13 of Avraham raising his eyes, and he sees a ram afterwards caught in the thicket by its horns. Avraham takes the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. We asked when we went through the verses, was this really necessary? Let's say the binding of Isaac never had this last element of actually offering the ram in place of his son. It's good, he's done. He went, he was willing to do it, he was about to, and God sent the angel to stop him. I see that you've passed, however we'll define what the point of the test was. It's done, you're a God-fearing man. But Avraham goes, and he does, in fact, offer this ram. And then we find in verse 14, he names the place of Hashem Yireh, that God will see, which we discussed last week, the idea of, we humans can't see. We are limited. You told me to do something which is completely contradictory and impossible, to slaughter the same son from whom you said I will have a multitude of nations. It can't be. But we don't know how things work out in this world. That's not our issue. Our issue is to move forward with what we're told to do. You see. God sees. He names the place that God sees, even though we ourselves don't. And then, after the sacrifice, after he names the place, a second angel calls out. And now he gets his blessings. Now he says, because you have done this thing and not withheld your son, your only one, I shall surely bless you, greatly increase your seed, and your descendants will inherit the gate of their enemy. That blessing of the second angel only comes when? After he offers the ram. So the issue that I'd like to discuss today is, what role does this ram have? Because even just from the text, it seems to be fairly significant. We could have done without it. Mm-hmm. Yet it's there. He offers it. And it's only after that offering do we even get the second angel calling out to give him all of these blessings. So I want to, first of all, let's discuss this point even further.
Because he was not commanded to offer.
That's correct. Exactly. Right? In other words, the command was, take your son. He was about to, and then God says, you did it, you passed the test. I asked you to, remember we had the language, raise him up. Mm-hmm. You raised him up, you can now take him back then. So go home, it's over. Mm-hmm. But we see that it's not.
No, I'm just thinking to myself, I mean, you can't just go home. If it was a human being that had said to him, don't do it, you know, the reaction would be to fall on the human being and hug him and weep and so on, but you can't fall on God, so this is offering the ram is like the equivalent of connecting with him.
Yeah, but lots of times you're not supposed to do anything for God unless you're commanded to do so. This he did on his own. It could have been not a good thing to do.
So who placed that ram?
Okay, so let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. So let me bring in some other sources. We're going to move off of the text for a little bit and bring in some other ideas that come up. So this ram comes up in other places. I discussed this last night. I mentioned to the people that were there as I was speaking, this is a very often a Rosh Hashanah type story. The reason why we blow the ram's horn on Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara says, is to recall the incident of the binding of Isaac, and therefore we use a horn specifically of the ram to bring about the merit for us of the binding of Isaac. But it's a Shavuot story also. It has to do with the receiving of the Torah. When the Jewish people arrive in the wilderness of Sinai, which they're there for 6 days before the Torah is given, they get there on Rosh Chodesh on the first of the month, the Torah is given on the sixth of the month. There's several dialogues between God and the Jewish people while they're there getting ready for the days. In one of the dialogues, God says to Moshe to tell the Jewish people, "V'higbalta sahar," set boundaries around the mountain, so that they don't go up too high while my presence is on it, because if anyone were to go up on the mountain while my presence is there, they will surely die. And when may they return and go back up onto the mountain? When do they have permission to ascend the mountain? So the Torah doesn't just say, well, when the Har Sinai is over, when you see my presence leave, you can go. No, you need a specific command to be able to go back up. What's the specific sign that they'll be allowed to go back up the mountain? So the Torah says, "Bimshoch hayovel," at the blast of the shofar, they'll be permitted to go back up to the mountain. So if you're reading the book of Shmos, the book of Exodus, and it says at the blast of the mountain, who's going to blow that shofar? What kind of shofar is that? Okay, what difference does it make? I don't know. So Rashi says, no. You know what shofar that was? Says Rashi, "The shofar shall ayilo shel Yitzchak haya." This was the ram's horn from Yitzchak's ayil. The ram that was offered as a sacrifice in place of Yitzchak of our story, that's the shofar that was used to be blown to allow the people back up onto the mountain. Now, the morale points out, when we talk this way, we don't mean the literal horn because it was completely burnt. But the representation, the spiritual significance of that ram's horn was blown at Har Sinai to allow the people back up onto the mountain. And in fact, the sages trace this ram throughout various aspects of Jewish history. The sages say that this ram was Nivra Bein Hashmashos. It was created in the moment right before Shabbos in the 6 days of creation. The specific ram that was going to be used for this sacrifice that Avram was going to use instead of his son was not just any ram which happened to be up there running around the top of the mountain. It was a designated ram that was created from the beginning of time. And every element of it, says the Medrash, did not go to waste. The Medrash says, "Gidin shel ayil." There were certain sinews of the ram. "Nasu mimenu asara nimen shel kinor David," were made into the strings on the harp of King David. King David had a harp that he used to play, the Anim Zmiros Shal Yisrael, the sweet singer of the Jewish people. He actually, the sages say, used to place his harp on top of his bed, and when the midnight winds would blow from the north, it would play the harp and would awaken him to sing song and praise to Hashem in the middle of the night. This harp of King David was constructed, say the sages, out of the sinews of the ram that was offered by Avraham on the top of the Har HaMoriah. The oro, the skin of the ram, says the Medrash, was the leather belt of Eliyahu HaNavi. The Navi, in the beginning of Malachim Beis, the very first chapter of the second book of Kings, talks about King Ahaziah, was one of the wicked kings of the northern tribes of Israel. This is the very last act of Elijah the prophet before he's taken up to heaven in a fiery chariot. So King Ahaziah takes ill, and he sends his messengers to ask of his idolatrous gods whether or not he'll recover from this illness. And as his messengers are seeking out the priests existence of this idolatrous God, this Baal, God, Hashem, sends Eliyahu HaNavi to intercept them and send a message back to the king that he's never going to get up from the bed again, he's going to die. Messengers return to the king and they say, King Ahaziah, we ran into somebody along the way and he told us to tell you you're never going to live. And the king said, who told you that? And they said, we don't know, but it was a hairy man and he was wearing a leather belt. And the king says, aha, that's Elijah the prophet. That leather belt was the identification that the king had that it was Elijah. And the Medrash says, where did he get the leather belt from? That's traced back to this ram that was offered. Continues the Medrash. The left horn.
But it's a symbol.
Correct. Yeah. The left horn of the aisle of the ram, says the Medrash, Takabo v'Har Sinai. That was the ram's horn. That was the shofar that was blown at Har Sinai. Aside from the verse that I just read you, the permission to go back onto the mountain, when the Torah was actually given, the Torah describes lightning and thunder, and the sound of the shofar was continuously getting stronger and stronger. What was that shofar? Who was blowing that shofar at the time of the giving of the Torah? That was the shofar from the left horn of the ram that Avraham sacrificed, following our story. And the right horn, that will be, the right horn is traditionally a larger horn than the one on the left. That will be the shofar, La'asid Lavo, in the days that will come to herald the days of Mashiach, as the Pasuk says, Vayavayomahu Yitaka b'shofar gadol, during those days the great shofar will be blown, heralding the Jewish people back to Eretz Yisrael, and that will be the shofar from the right side of the aisle. When you look at this particular Medrash with the sages, look at what they're tracing. What's the common theme amongst these factors? You start with the beginning of time and Avram at the binding of Isaac, and then you can trace the Davidic dynasty and the coming of Mashiach from King David himself. His harp is made up of the sinews from this particular ram. Eliyahu HaNavi, who's going to herald the times of the Mashiach. We have the shofar that's blown at the time of Kabbalah Sator, the receiving of the Torah, and then the shofar that's going to be blown, bringing us back at the times of the Mashiach. All of that the sages see within those episodes, elements of this story, this sacrifice that Abraham brings. You say the story should have ended before the sacrifice. The sages see great significance in this particular sacrifice. Not only do we see that the ram was created from the beginning of time, the sages say from the 6 days of creation this ram was already there, but we've seen a couple of other factors. A, we just mentioned that the blessing is given to Abraham only after he actually offers up this ram. We also found something else. We found, I believe we studied this Rashi together. How is the ram, how does Avram find the ram? Where is it?
In the thicket.
And how is it caught by the thicket?
By its horns.
How does a ram get caught by its thorn, by its horns in a thicket? It's an odd way for a ram to get caught, because that means it was sort of not looking where it was going. It was like walking with its head down into a thicket. Like, how did that happen? So Rashi's bothered by that. The sages are bothered by that. And the sages say that this was the Satan, the angel trying to stop Avram from fulfilling his mission. The ram itself was running towards Avram because it was coming to fulfill its mission. It had been created since the beginning of time for this purpose. It's now running towards Avram to be able to fulfill that mission. And the Satan tried to push it off to the side and got it caught into the thicket. So I would just add that as another element. The sages see something of such significance in this act that the Satan, so to speak, is trying to stop it from happening. Avram's brought many sacrifices at this point in his life already. But there's something about this one where it needs to be done, and there's great significance in it being done, in that the sages see the Satan trying to stop it from happening. It's created from the beginning of time. And once it's offered, the sages trace the elements or traces of this sacrifice throughout major moments in Jewish history, from the giving of the Torah to Mashiach, to David HaMelech, to Eliyahu HaNavi, are all somehow encompassed in this blowing of the of this sacrifice that's offered by Avraham. Okay, let's try to understand it a little bit. Let's take a look. If you look in your sheets, top of page 3, we have a conversation. that Rashi tells us takes place between Avram and Hashem after the angel tries to stop Avram. Avram is already, he sent forth his hand, he's got the knife in his hand, he's ready to slaughter his son, and the angel says, no, don't do anything. And we saw a double language in that verse. Do not send forth your hand against the land, nor do anything to him. So we saw this Rashi inside once, we'll go over it again. Why is there a double language that the angel says, not only may you not send forth your hand against the lad, but also may you not do anything to him. You told me that already. You told me not to send forth my hand. So the Rashi says, because there was a conversation, we've seen this a couple times, in which the sages pick up on oddities in the text, in that we're missing a conversation, right? Mm-hmm. The classic one we have is in the beginning of the story. Take your son, your only son, the one you love, Yitzchak. Mm-hmm. And the sages said, there was a conversation taking place. Take your son. I have two sons. Take your only son. They're both only sons. Take the one you love. I love them both. Take Yitzchak. But the text, in terms of being very terse, yet trying to layer meaning and understanding, has tools that it uses for that. And the sages flesh out, so to speak, those conversations. So here you have an angel saying two things when he didn't need to say two things. So the sages said, because there's a conversation that's taking place here. What's the full conversation? It's on the box, note number 13 on the top of your page. Al tishlach, do not stretch forth your hand, is the words of the text that Rashi is commenting on, to slaughter him. You may not slaughter him. Avram says to the angel, or says directly to Hashem, in Cain, if so, l'chinom b'asi l'kan, I have come here in vain. I've come here for nothing. What do you mean, don't send forth my hand? I came all the way here, I've traveled 3 days, I'm ready to sacrifice my son, and now you tell me not to? The whole thing was a waste? Let me inflict a wound on him and extract a little blood. Angel said to him, the second phrase that we have in the Torah, do not do anything to him. Do not do the slightest thing to him. Do not cause him any blemish. Very strange comments from Avram. Avram's got a complaint. He was just tested. Test was, take your son, raise him up as a sacrifice in the place that I will show you. And he does. He travels. He brings him up as an offering. And the angel says, now, stop. Done. And Avram says, no, I want to do it. What do you mean you want to do it? I don't understand. The only reason why you want to do it in the first place was because God told you to. Now God told you, so what are you doing? What's this? I came here in vain? When you came here in vain? This was a great test. You've passed. Somehow Abraham feels that at this moment it would still be considered in vain, as if nothing has happened. So I saw Rabbi Yeshua Hartman, he writes the footnotes on the bottom of the Maharal, writes, and based on the Maharal's writing, when he understands, if you look carefully at Avram's words, according to the sages, what is he saying? What did he do in vain? Come here in vain. Meaning, as if Avram is saying, if you wanted to test me to see if I'd be willing to offer my son as a sacrifice, I could have done that in my backyard. You didn't need to schlep me 3 days' journey to a place that's going to become the holiest place in Jewish life. The place where the Beis HaMikdash will stand, the place where the Jewish people will rendezvous with you throughout all of history, just to see if I'd be willing to do it. I could have done that at home. Something has to happen here, as if Avram was saying, the point of this test of the human being, me, giving back to you, God, my most prized possession, showing that I have nothing other than you. There is nothing that exists in life other than God. Everything that I have is a gift from you. And if you ask me to give it to you, there is nothing else, even though it doesn't make any sense because it doesn't make sense to kill one son. And it doesn't make sense because you told me through this son I will have children as numerous as the stars. That makes no sense on every level. But there is nothing other than you. And here is the place where I'm going to sanctify that place with that offering. It can't be that you brought me here and not be able to do anything. Can't be. So Avraham looks up, so he says, so at least you must mean for me to take some blood. And Hashem says, no, I want nothing from the child. That's not how we function. To which Avraham realizes, the story can't be over yet then. There must be some way of then expressing, which is what the carbon is. If you remember, we saw that whole piece from Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch said, what word did Avraham say to his lads and the donkey when he said, I'm leaving you? He said, what are we going to do? We're going to bow down. And Rav Hirsch asked, who are you fooling? You're taking wood, fire, and a knife. You're clearly going to bring an offering. Why are you saying you're going to bow down? And Rav Hirsch described, because that's what an offering is. An offering is just a manifestation of the Jew's complete subjugation and offering himself up to God. And Avraham here is at this place, at that moment, willing to give his son. It has to be manifested in something. So he finds the ram, designated from the beginning of time. The Maral explains, this is the fulfillment, the bringing into reality all of the potential, all of the intentions, all that had been prepared for. The aisle, this ram, represents its fulfillment in the world. It's being brought into existence, because God doesn't really want a human sacrifice. But all of the intentions that had gone into, I am ready to do that. I understand what it means that I have nothing, the child that I've waited 100 years for, and that you promised me, and that I don't get it. But you see, I don't see, and I'm willing to give it to you. The realization of that is in the ram. And without that, it's left hanging. And the ram represents the conclusion, the actual bringing into the world of all of those thoughts and all of those intentions. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's tachas b'no. Remember, we saw that phrase. It's in place of his son. Her first also asked, so you're ready to give your son, right? And then says, forget it. Don't bring your son. So you're just going to take a random animal that you have no connection to. You're not even giving anything of your own. How could that be considered in place of your son? So when Avraham takes this, look at source number 16. It's tachas b'no, instead of his son. He offers this, it's on page 3, he offers his ram in place of his son. Since it is written already, the pasuk said, he offered it up as a burnt offering. Nothing is missing in the text. Why does the text have to include it? He offered it as a burnt offering in place of his son. You don't need to say, just say he offered it as a ram. He found the ram, he offered it. No, he offered it in place of his son. What does that mean? Over every sacrificial act that he performed, he prayed, Yehi Ratzon, may it be your will, that this should be deemed as if it were being done to my son. As if my son were being slaughtered, as if his blood were sprinkled, as if my son were flayed, as if he were burnt and reduced to ashes. So that Avraham prays with every step of the sacrifice, let this be in place of my, I'm ready to, I was willing, I realize there is nothing other than you in the world, but you don't want my son. But may it be your will that this ram, every step of the way, be considered as if I had, in fact, offered up my son. And the sages use the words, the ashes of Yitzchak. As if Yitzchak had actually been burnt to ashes. But Rashi quotes it in a pasuk in Vayikra. The pasuk says, V'zacharti es brisi Avraham. I will remember the covenant of Avraham. I'll remember it. V'es brisi Yitzchak, and the covenant of Yitzchak. V'afes Yaakov as brisi as exact lashon, and the covenant of Yaakov I'll remember as well. And Rashi points out that the word to remember is associated with the covenant with Abraham, and he'll remember the covenant with Yaakov. But Yitzchak, it just says he has a covenant. It doesn't say that God remembers it. Rashi says, you know why God doesn't remember the covenant of Yitzchak? Because he doesn't have to remember, because it's always in front of him. The ashes of Yitzchak are bound up in front of me always. The sages say, as if God is saying, I don't have to remember that. I see it all the time. Avram, I have to remember. Yaakov, I have to remember. Yitzchak, I see his ashes. What do you mean his ashes? He was taken down. But the fulfillment of that desire of Avraham, all of his intention, all of his prayers of may it be your will that this be viewed as his ashes, says if he was successful, and it was. Tell you something fascinating. So there's in the beginning of the next parsha, after what we studied, is the death of Sarah. Sarah dies in the very next passage after the story of the binding of Isaac. So Rashi quotes, why did she die? Why here? When she had heard about what was taking place, her neshama left her, she dies. But the actual way the Medrash, the sages describe it, is a little different than what's often understood. It's often understood as if the Satan or some angel came and told her and she dies. The Medrash actually says, the way the Medrash describes it, and I would read it to you inside, I didn't bring it. The Medrash says, when Yitzchak came home to Sarah, she said to him, "Where have you been, my son?" And Yitzchak says, "Well, Dad took me, we went over mountains and into the valleys and over mountains and into valleys, and we finally came to a certain mountaintop, and we climbed the mountain, and he built an altar, and he bound me up, and he put me on it, and he had a knife in his hand ready to slaughter me, and if it wouldn't have been for an angel that called out, 'Avraham, Avraham,' he would have done it." And then the Medrash says, and he didn't have a chance to finish the story until she died. Now, what part of the story is she missing?
The ram.
Correct. Not the fact that she didn't hear the end of the story, that he didn't actually do it. Because who's telling this to her?
He is.
He is. The Medrash says Yitzchak is talking to her. But what didn't he get to yet? That it was actually fulfilled. As if there was a problem. As if Yitzchak had some type of blemish. Or that Avraham wasn't ready to do it. Or that Yitzchak wasn't ready to do it. But she never heard the end of the story of that Avram actually put it into the world in the form of the ram. That part she never got to. That ram represents that fulfillment of that potential, of that desire. And where does it trace itself? Where do the sages see the manifestation of this ram? They see it in the giving of the Torah. The giving of the Torah is the fulfillment, the completion of the purpose of creation, which had started back in the beginning of time, waiting until the Jewish people would be there ready to receive the Torah. Sages say many times, I'm sure we've quoted this, that the world was sort of hanging in the balance until the Jewish people would come. If they would receive the Torah, everything would be great. And if they would say no thanks, then the world would return to the tohu vavohu, the void and desolation that existed in the beginning of time. So at that moment of fulfillment, the sages see traces of the ram. The left horn of the ram is the shofar that blows during the receiving of the Torah. And then we trace it through King David and Eliyahu, who are going to be the manifestation of the Davidic dynasty. David, who also is the fulfillment of the years of Adam, the original Adam HaRishon, gave his years to King David that he should live, based on another medrash which we'll leave aside for now. But in that manifestation, and in Eliyahu HaNavi, who's going to herald the times of the Mashiach, whose ram, what horn is going to be blown to bring in the Mashiach, we also find this aisle, this completion of the purpose, the fulfillment of all of the potential that had been there, bringing it into the reality of the world.
Yes.
Why the shofar? What's the significance of the shofar specifically, where we take the ram, we take its two horns, and we blow a shofar? I just want to explain, the Maral explains the significance of the shofar. The Maral says the shofar has two elements to it. The first element of a shofar is a lekabetz vele'asof, to gather together. The sound of the shofar is a call of come gather. It's that representation of something is going on. You're being called to arms, called to attention, called to an announcement. It's that bugle that sounds to, in the camps, everybody to the flagpole. That's the representation of the shofar. Specifically, so when you have a shofar being blown from a divine sense, it's a call specifically to Hashem. It's a call to gather to Him. And therefore, Kabbalah Sator, the time that the Jewish people received the Torah at Har Sinai, so it's a coming together on a national scale. In the same way the Maral writes, Maral explains, Yitzchak came together, so to speak, on an individual level, bringing every element of his being to be ready to be there and to be a sacrifice for God. So in the same way as he has put himself in his entirety on the altar, "Tie me up tight, Dad," he says, "I don't want to move lest I become blemished." Nationally, the Jewish people are called together at the time of the giving of the Torah to receive our purpose, our mission, our task through the giving of the Torah. But a shofar represents more than just a gathering together. It's a gathering together, specifically the Maral writes, in the form of geula, in the form of redemption. When a Jew hears the blast of the shofar, it represents a gathering to be redeemed. Meaning to say, the Gemara actually says, someone who sees a shofar in their dreams, there's a Gemara in one of the, it goes through a various things that a person can see in their dream and what it represents. So a shofar represents redemption. You could look forward, you could be mitzapel geula, you could look forward to being redeemed from whatever personal issue one is going through if one sees a shofar in their dream. Shofar gathers. What is the exile? The exile are Jewish people in pockets around the world. The pockets might be large. The New York pocket of Jews is significant. But it's still just a pocket of Jews dispersed amongst the four corners of the earth. Gathering together, when they hear the call of that shofar, and they gather, so it's not just a gathering, but it's a gathering specifically to remove ourselves from the dominion and subjugation of the nations of the world, to put ourselves only under the flagpole of Hashem. So that it's a gathering of redemption. When the shofar blows, it represents that ability. Which is why the shofar of Mashiach will also come from this ram's horn. The Mashiach is going to herald the Jewish people with a shofar blast. Yitakal b'shofar gadol, it will be a great blast of the shofar, and all of the nations will gather, uvohu ha'ovdim from Eretz Ashur, all of those spread out and lost amongst the nations of the world will come together, representing that redemption from being under the dominion of the nations of the world to being under specifically and only the dominion of God. And therefore we find the two shofar blasts of Kabbalah Sator, where the Jewish people come together themselves in unity, and then at the end of days we'll be gathered together from amongst the nations of the world. Those two shofar blasts come from the same ram that represents the fulfillment of the actualization of all of the potential that had been there, that Avraham had all of his intentions of giving everything back to Hashem, but Hashem says, I don't want your child, but I actually offer up the ram instead. And that actualization has been manifested in the shofars of Kabbalah Satorah and of Mashiach. One final thought. Gemara says in Megillah, Bo Rei, come and see Kama Chaviv in Yisrael, how dear and beloved the Jewish people are to Hashem. Shekol Makom Shegoldu, every place that the Jewish people have been exiled to, Shechina Imahem, the Divine Presence is exiled with us. So that we don't just go into exile by ourselves, but every place that the Jewish people go into exile, Hashem sends His Divine Presence with us in exile. Golu L'Mitzrayim, we were exiled to Egypt as a nascent nation, Shechina Imahem, and the Divine Presence was with us where? The Gemara quotes the Pasuk to show that. Golu L'Elam, sent into a place known as Elam, the Shechina was with us. Golu L'Babel, we were exiled to Babylonia, Shechina Imahem, the Divine Presence was with us there. Golu L'Edom, we were exiled into the Roman exile in which we are still in today, Shechina Imahem, and the Divine Presence is with us here as well. Ve'af kishehem asidin li'goel, and when we will be in the future redeemed, Shechina Imahem, the Divine Presence will return with us from our exile back to the land of Israel. While we're here, the Presence is with us, and as we go back, when we hear that call of the shofar, the Shechina will return with us. That process begins each and every day while we're still in the exile, when we gather to daven together. The Gemara says, Kol ha-mispalol im ha-tzibur, anyone who comes to daven together with a tzibur, with a congregation, with a minyan, ki'ilu podali filivni mibein ha-umos. It's as if he has redeemed me and my children from amongst the nations of the world. Well, explains, because what's the call of the shofar going to do? It's a gathering. And when you gather, the redemption from underneath the dominion of the nations of the world under the flag of Hashem. On a miniature level, every time 10 Jews come together to daven, what are they doing? They're leaving their homes and they're gathering together to establish themselves under the flagpole of Hashem. They're coming to shul. They're coming to say Baruch Hu, coming to say Yehi Shmei Rabba. They're coming to recognize what it is that we're doing. That's the purpose of everything. The Ramban writes, every time a Jew recognizes his Creator, that's the purpose of all of creation. A miniature redemption takes place every time a minyan takes place, even in the exile. The concept of gathering together to remove the yoke of the nations of the world upon us, to accept upon us only the element of the dominion of Hashem. And that process, which starts every single time Jews gather to daven, is a process that will continue in mass when we hear the call of that shofar from the right side of the aisle of Yitzchak, from the ram's horn of Yitzchak, to bring us back there to Israel, to bring us back home, to establish the monarchy of King David with his harp, and fulfill all of those promises of the Torah which we heard with the left hand ram's horn, which was designated from the beginning of time of the fulfillment of all of the intentions and the bringing into actualization of all of that, giving everything that we have back to Hashem.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.